pigs. Early one morning, any morning, we can set out with the least possible baggage and discover the world. Thomas A. Clarke. I locked my bike by the pond on the village green. It was a quiet morning and nobody was about. Village greens conjure peaceful images of cricket matches, community celebrations, and maypole dances. But historically, village greens were about more than recreation. Since the Middle Ages, they have been an area of common grassland for the use of everyone, often with a pond where fish were reared, cartwheels soaked to prevent them shrinking, clothes washed, cattle watered, and dishonest traders punished on ducking stools as social humiliation. Completing today's bucolic scene was an old flint and brick oast house. Buildings like these were once used to dry hops for brewing beer, so the distinctive conical shape is common in hop-growing areas. I set off along a narrow lane beneath an archway of hedges and trees. A notice pinned to a fence said, "Do not feed horses no carrot or apple." Horses' hooves had chewed the earth to sloppy mud, so I picked my way carefully down the edge of the path. A red sign declaring "Private Grounds" was nailed to an old beech tree on the edge of a copse. "No through access," read another. "Private, no parking, residents only." Even where there were footpaths, it felt as though they'd only been allowed grudgingly, with fences and cautionary signs keeping me strictly on the narrowest strip of land it was possible to walk on. It was a cheerless affair, a mean-spirited granting of minimal space. At one point, the path became a claustrophobic tunnel between high fence panels that was barely wide enough for my shoulders. A squirrel sitting on this fence spotted me. Its nearest safe tree was about 20 metres away. Unfortunately for the furry fellow, I was between the tree and him. The squirrel decided that the lure of the tree was greater than the terror of the human, so it sprinted along the top of the fence, a clitter-clatter of tiny claws zooming straight past me within easy arm's reach before leaping for the safety of the high branches. As a fond feeder of birds, I am in constant conflict with the grey squirrels in my garden who try to scoff all the seed I put out. I have a squirrel-proof bird feeder outside my writing shed, complete with a squirrel-proof concave baffle to stop them climbing the pole. But even so, the blighters drop from trees or leap from my shed roof to try to get at the food. I have to admire their agility, even though their greed and population size annoys me. Squirrels can make enormous vertical or horizontal leaps using their powerful double-jointed legs. They can swivel their back ankle joints and so run down a tree as easily as they run up it. Cats don't have this hypermobility, hence their tendency to get stuck up trees. Feeding birds is a simple pleasure and an easy way to connect to nature. There is a charming line in Ronan Hessian's novel Leonard and Hungry Paul about a mother who looked after everyone in her life as though they were her garden birds. That is to say, with unconditional pleasure and generosity. But, like many things, feeding birds also has a negative environmental side. My heart sank a little when I learnt this. It is so hard to cause no damage, even when you're trying to do the right thing, such as switching from cow's milk, which is terrible for emissions and polluting rivers, then learning that your smug almond milk is bad for bees, or flipping from burgers' awful impact on deforestation to discovering that each smashed avocado you post on Instagram guzzles 320 litres of precious water. Feeding birds can spread diseases, and it skews populations towards those that most benefit from the calorie boost. Adaptable and aggressive generalists such as great tits, nuthatches, and parakeets. Timid birds, such as the wood warbler and marsh tit, have suffered sharp declines as a result. This grid square felt like an old-fashioned rural landscape. There were farms with cows, sheep, pigs, horses, goats and chickens, and none of the old McDonald's litter I'd grown used to. The rolling countryside was thick with woodland, and there was also more birdsong than a week ago. More green shoots too, as leaf buds sprayed the woods in their first hopeful emerald mist. I nibbled some fresh hawthorn leaves, a tasty morsel once known as bread and cheese, which made me think of the yellowhammer I'd seen earlier, a bird whose song sounds like it's calling a little bit of bread and no cheese over and over. There was an old folk anecdote that hawthorn blossom reeked like London's great plague. Bodies used to line the house for days before burial, so people were familiar with the smell of death. And scientists have since discovered that the blossom does actually contain trimethylamine, a chemical present in decaying flesh. Three buzzards circled high overhead, and a mischief of concerned magpies grew agitated by their presence. I began counting the magpies, reciting the rhyme I remembered from childhood. One for sorrow, two for mirth, three for a funeral, and four for a birth. Magpies have been linked to superstitions and omens for centuries, with the earliest variation of the famous rhyme first written down in 1780. Folklore surrounds the magpie. Salute it to stave off misfortune, greet it for luck, or fear it being in collusion with the devil. For this is the bird, it was said, that refused to mourn Christ's death with the other birds, that refused to enter Noah's ark, and instead alighted on the roof and cursed throughout the voyage. In Korea, by contrast, they say that a magpie predicts the auspicious arrival of visitors. The magpie's reputation for thievery stems back to 1815, with a French melodrama featuring a servant girl sentenced to death for stealing silverware, though the thief turned out to be the master's pet magpie. Rossini then turned the story into the opera The Thieving Magpie, besmirching the poor bird's name forever. Scientists have found no evidence that they're more attracted to shiny objects than other birds. And what of magpies' reputation for killing birds? They are noisy and vigorous predators, certainly, but there is little evidence they have an adverse effect on songbird populations. Ecologist Tim Burkhead defends them, saying, "Cats are undoubtedly a monumental threat to songbirds, but it's magpies that incur the wrath of the average bird lover. If magpies were rare, people would travel far to see them. In bright sunlight, they are the most exquisitely beautiful birds, with that lovely long tail and iridescence." I walked over some more fields and encountered my map's first pigs, fenced into an area of woodland that they had turned completely to mud. The pigs looked as happy as, well, I can't think of a simile, but they looked very content. "Morning, pigs," I called. Three little ones paused their rooting to stare at me from beneath floppy ears. Pigs have been put out to pasture in woodland for centuries, allowing them to forage for acorns, beech mast or chestnuts, a practice known as pannage, began in medieval times as a privilege granted on common land or in royal forests. As well as fattening up the pigs with free food, pannage was a useful way of turning the soil and also protected ponies and cattle from hoovering up too many green acorns, which are poisonous to them. So long as the pigs are rotated through different areas in small numbers, this ancient system of silvopasture, or agroforestry, is sustainable. A mixture of trees, pasture and a few grazing animals is better than grassland alone for sequestering carbon and helping to counteract the livestock's emissions. Besides helping the environment, Agroforestry generates income on separate levels, from foraged nuts, berries and fungi, to rearing livestock and timber production. This shields farmers from market fluctuations. Agroforestry is good for the farm, good for the farmer, and can even be good for the planet if done correctly. Leaving the pigs, I went past patches of primrose, a plump, stuffed panda perched in the fork of a pollarded tree, and a ramshackle wooden hut. If the homemade cabin was a kid's playground, the construction was impressive. If adults built it for some other function, then it was very much beyond its prime. I often come across mysteries in the woods like this, signs that someone once did something here for some reason, sometime. I wish I could meet everyone who has ever walked past one spot, all gathered here at the same time, from dog walkers in Gore-Tex, back through woodsmen and deserting soldiers, hunting lords and peasant poachers, back further to legionnaires and Neanderthals, and then all the way back through the mammoths to the iguanodons. Across the valley, an old timber-framed cottage was tucked onto a hillside in a fold of woodland, like a scene from Cider with Rosie. I headed towards it. A sign cautioned drivers to be careful of badgers crossing the narrow lane. Lining the grassy public footpath leading to the house were eight small, homemade wooden crosses, the surrounding earth sprinkled with yellow primroses, and each cross bearing the dates and name of a beloved pet. I stopped to chat over the low fence with an elderly lady who was pottering around her garden. She told me cheerfully that her home had been built in 1900, and I've been here nearly as long as that. I asked what lived in her pond, for I've been on a long and fruitless mission to find frog spawn on my map. "Oh yes," she told me, "we get loads of frogs, newts too, and dragonflies." As a boy, I used to push through the beech hedge at the bottom of our garden, out into the fields, and collect gloopy balls of frog spawn from a nearby spring. We kept them in an old sink outside the back door until they hatched and hopped away. It was fascinating to watch the tadpoles grow into froglets. I'd like to watch the same miracle unfolding today outside my shed. But because she was a frail old lady, I didn't want to trouble her by asking if I could come into her garden and collect a bit of her frog spawn. She would probably have thought me very weird had I filled up my water bottle with frog spawn anyway. I shall continue my search. For meteorologists, spring begins at the start of March. For astronomers, it is the equinox. For me, the season was already well underway with the first frogs born and the beginning of a new generation of wildlife.